The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and this is part one of 10 World-Changing Ideas, our two-part series produced in cooperation with Scientific American magazine. 10 World-Changing Ideas is the title of the feature story in the December 2011 issue of Scientific American, and it profiles 10 examples of cutting-edge research and tech that could shape the future of society, our planet, and even our survival as a species. Before we get into the details, I wanted to explore a little bit about the process of creating this article. I'm joined by Michael Moyer, the senior editor in charge of technology coverage for Scientific American. Previously, he spent 8 years at Popular Science magazine, where he was the articles editor, and he was awarded the 2005 American Institute of Physics Science Writing Award for his article, Journey to the Tenth Dimension. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I think we should start by pointing out that these are 10 potentially world-changing ideas, correct? You're not reviewing technology that's already made a big impact.
That's right. We were looking for things that are right on that interesting cusp where they're kind of coming out of the labs and moving into the commercial world in such a way where we think that they'll be scalable and that they're going to be able to have a big impact on the world in the years to come. Now, of course, predictions are very difficult, especially about the future. So, of course, not all 10 of these are going to radically change everything that we know about the world that we live in. But they're what we think are good examples of simple, clever ideas that can really shape the future.
So what qualifies a technology as world-changing, then?
Well, we look for technologies in a few different ways. One of the most important factors we look in is whether it's going to be able to change people's day-to-day lives or their health or the environment in a significant way.
Well, 10 is a nice round number, but I'd imagine that you had many ideas to choose from. How did you go about deciding which projects that you would choose?
Well, this is the third year we've created our world-changing ideas package. And what we do every year, beginning very early in the year, is we start assembling lists of interesting technologies that we hear about, things coming out of the labs. We have a network of scientists whom we depend on, of fellow writers and authors and science writers who follow this sort of stuff for a living. And we start collecting lots of things that come out of places like MIT, Caltech, and smaller labs around the world. Then towards the summertime, we start culling and start trying to figure out which of these ideas are simple enough to be able to kind of understand in a full way in the short treatment that we're able to give it in the magazine, but also is clear enough for people to understand how it could really affect the world.
So have you already started looking for next year's big ideas?
We finished putting this, the World Changing Ideas 2011 together about a month and a half ago. And about a month ago, I started looking for World Changing Ideas for 2012.
Wonderful. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
And now, here are 5 of this year's 10 World Changing Ideas, as chosen by Scientific American. Christopher Mims is a journalist who specializes in sustainability and technology. He blogs for Technology Review, Grist, Smart Planet, and Fast Company, and writes articles for Wired, Scientific American, Technologist, and Slate. In another life, he was a crayfish neurologist specializing in functional and anatomical studies via magnetic resonance imaging. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
So, of all the world-changing ideas, I have to say this one is the creepiest. Very cool, but also creepy. The wallet in your skin. Do explain, sir.
Well, there's a security expert named Bruce Schneier. He likes to point out that everything that we rely on you know, whether it's our credit card or, you know, its online equivalent, is just a pointer to our identity in a database somewhere, which is our financial identity. And there's no reason that that pointer has to be a physical object, right? Sometimes it's something immaterial like a PIN or a password that we've memorized.
Right.
It could also be something in our own bodies. The idea here is that we can use basically our own hands as a unique way to point to our financial lives. And this in the future might allow us to basically not carry a wallet or anything else. In the past, people have tried to, I mean, we've all seen these in science fiction films where people are using, you know, the pattern of their iris or their fingerprint or a face scan to gain access to a building or a secured facility or something. But there's kind of problems with each of these, what are called biometrics. And there's a new solution that is being pioneered by Fujitsu. What this solution does is there's a tiny sensor that they put next to a cash register, and it takes a picture of your palm with infrared light, and it can see in three dimensions the structure of the veins within your hand. And that turns out to be a very unique and individualized marker, unique even within potentially millions of people, which is what's required for a biometric to be a unique identifier, you know, within an entire population in a country, let's say. So Fujitsu has actually started putting these sensors and the databases attached to them into places like lunch lines in one particular school system in Florida. And the idea is that these kids don't have very long to eat lunch to begin with. And in the old days, you know, they were using cards and, you know, they're kids, so maybe they would lose the cards or something. But with this system, the kid walks up to the cash register. The person at the cash register notes what they're buying, and the kid just kind of waves their hand at this little infrared sensor and instantly knows who they are, and it debits their account. This system has also been deployed in hospitals to identify people. One of the advantages is that you don't have to be conscious for it to work. And the general idea is that in the future, we could move toward a sort of walletless world where instead of relying on a credit card or something to be our unique identifier, we'd use our own bodies. Now, there are some objections to this. One is, you know, if somebody steals your credit card information, you can always get a new credit card. If they steal your biometric information, you can't just get a new hand or a new iris or something. On the other hand, this is pretty hard to fake. So you can't really, from a security perspective, attack it at the sensor itself. So for instance, there's a lot of research into using our faces as a unique identifier. The problem with that is most of the systems can be fooled by a picture of you. But, you know, something that's as unique as the three-dimensional structure of the veins in your palm as rendered by this system at this point in time is pretty hard to fake. And it's also really convenient. Probably one of the safest or most secure biometrics is systems that take a picture of your iris. The problem is that's very obtrusive. You have to lean into something that's kind of poking you in the eye socket, and it might take a second for it to scan your eye. Whereas just waving your hand at a cash register or at anywhere you can think of, a turnstile on a subway, etc., it's just very simple. It just takes a few milliseconds for the sensor to get a picture, and then it searches its database for a match. And when it finds you, you're done. And so the idea is that eventually this might replace everything that we use as means of exchange right now, whether it's cash or credit.
Are the patterns in your veins actually more unique than fingerprints then?
Yes. It's my understanding that the three-dimensional pattern of veins in your palm is more unique than your fingerprints. And also, in some respects, harder to fake. So one of the problems with fingerprints are that we're leaving them everywhere all the time. So right. It's not hard for somebody to pick up your fingerprint and make a mold.
Okay, now you mentioned that one of the advantages of this is that you can identify people when they're unconscious. But what about when they're dead? Does the technology rely on your veins being, I'm probably not putting this correctly, but full?
I think it does. I think that's one of the things that makes it harder to fake. So I don't think this would work when you're dead. I mean, you wouldn't use this for, you know, recognizing people in a morgue. But that's also an advantage. I mean, you couldn't just chop someone's hand off and
thank you.
And use that.
You see, and I have watched too many science fiction movies where they take out the eye and such and hold it up to the scanner. And that's creepy. And actually, again, this whole thing is creepy. I actually spoke to my son about this, and he was promptly repulsed. So why does this seem more creepy than retina scans? Because that's pretty creepy, really, when you think about it.
Personally, I don't find it all that creepy. I think part of the creep factor might be if you've seen the images that the sensor captures, it's a little bit like one of those medical models. It's kind of an x-ray of the hand. You're looking at the blood vessels, and there's something kind of 19th century Victorian Frankenstein about that.
But this is more accurate, so that's good. But are there other distinctive body parts that we'll be scanning in the future, perhaps?
I mean, the interesting thing about the attempt to replace the credit card with biometrics is that it's kind of a puzzle. So security researchers think of these ways that people could uniquely identify themselves, and then other security researchers try to crack those methods and show a way that they're not as secure. So ironically, right after I wrote this piece, I heard about something that I thought was at least as cool. And it kind of makes face recognition, which is a fairly insecure biometric, work pretty well. And this is a system that I think they're rolling out now, and it's based on your smartphone. So your smartphone knows where you are because it has a GPS receiver in it. And there's a payment system where if I'm within, say, 50 feet of a cash register in a Starbucks and this app is running, the barista or whoever's on this cash register is going to see a little grid of faces, profile photos of everybody who has this app running, who's within 50 feet of this cash register. And when they recognize you at the time of payment, they just tap your face. So by narrowing the pool of faces down to the one up to, let's say, a dozen people who are standing next to the cash register, you're able to make an insecure biometric, which is the face, fairly secure. And there's an added layer of security, which is that human beings are much cleverer about detecting fake faces than, let's say, cameras and artificial vision systems are. I mean, you can't fool the barista at Starbucks with a life-size photo of someone else's face.
Oh, the future is weird, sir.
It is.
That was Christopher Mims, sustainability and technology journalist. Fred Guterl is the executive editor of Scientific American. He's also the author of the book Fate of the Species, about how humans are at risk of extinction and how to avoid it, which Bloomsbury will publish in May. Fred, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Bitcoin.
The Bitcoin is a digital currency. It's like the dollar or the euro. Let's hope it does better than the euro. You know, now when you buy something online, you use a middleman. You use a credit card company, or you use PayPal, or you use your bank, you know. And Bitcoin, the idea behind Bitcoin is to make an actual currency that can be exchanged digitally, but that doesn't require a clearinghouse, you know, a third party who takes out fees and such to do it. And it uses encryption technology, which has been around for a while, but it hasn't really been applied in this realm. And each person has a public address, which anyone can find, and then you have a private key. And so if you want to send money in Bitcoin to someone else, then you use your private key to send it to them at their public address. And it's all encrypted so that theoretically it's not going to get hacked.
So it's basically just transferring code over like a peer-to-peer
yes.
network. So why would this be better than using PayPal or a credit card?
Well, because those things involve fees. You know, whenever you use a credit card, the credit card company is taking a slice of the business. The founders of Bitcoin have decided that what the world needs is some kind of digital currency that would be able to stand on its own. It's, I guess, the difference between a check and cash. So if you write someone a check, you give them a piece of paper, they have to go to the bank and they have to cash it. But if you give them money, then there's no middleman. You just give them something that's directly got some value.
Well, there's also the anonymous nature of money. Is Bitcoin linked to a person, or could you use it anonymously?
It's anonymous. One person sends it to another. but it doesn't really leave a trace. So this is, for this reason, it actually could be used to launder money. You know, when you move money physically, it creates a trail. So if you pay somebody by credit card or you transfer money through a bank, it creates a paper trail. If you carry money across a border in a suitcase, it doesn't really create a trail, but you can get stopped by a customs agent, I suppose. Bitcoin is more like cash, except it's digital, so there's no way to sort of keep track of it. This is both the benefit and the problem of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. I suppose, because it creates the possibility that people could use it to transfer money that doesn't come under scrutiny.
What would stop enterprising hackers from just creating their own Bitcoins, then, if it's just code?
There's a supply, like there's a money supply. You know, there's a supply of Bitcoin out there. There's a finite number of Bitcoin. And that has to be managed in a way that a central bank would manage money. You'd issue it. So it's not just like you can send code and create your own Bitcoin. I mean, it would be great if each one of us could just print our own money,
That's what I was thinking.
Some people actually do. Right. Some counterfeiters do that. I mean, printers are very good now, so they've had to get better with currency and make it harder to replicate with a color printer. Bitcoin has had some security problems, which has sort of tarnished it a bit. And the value of the currency, because it is a currency, has really whipsawed. At one point, last year, it dropped to 10% of its peak value. And it's since come back. You know, for a while, people were willing to sort of pronounce it dead on arrival. But, in the last few months, it's actually shown some life. It's not a slam dunk that this is going to change the world, but I think the idea of digital currency is an idea that is out there and that really has a kind of a compelling idea behind it.
Now, and people are using it now, right?
Yes, people are using it now.
Well, how many companies are accepting it? Because that's really the big thing, right?
Not very many. I mean, a hundred or so, it's something like that. It hasn't taken off. It's a big idea that's sort of kind of still staggering out in the real world.
What would it have to take for it to take off?
It would have to be accepted by a lot of people. For it to be accepted by a lot of people, I mean, that's all a currency is something that we all accept. It has value. So now, what would it take for people to accept it? Gee, who knows? I mean, maybe one of the things that it would take would be for it to have some kind of stable value. You know, it's been whipsawing all over the place. It's gone way up and down. So I don't know who would, you wouldn't want to put your life savings in Bitcoin right now, because it would just be too volatile. But maybe people would use it just for the purposes of transferring money. Maybe they would convert your money to Bitcoin and then you transfer it and then you'd convert it back to something else.
But like right now, Bitcoins are kind of like Esperanto.
It makes sense. It is a bit like that.
But no one's using it.
But it's a big idea. It could change the world.
That was Fred Guterl, the executive editor of Scientific American. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scientific American's world-changing ideas after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Jerry Glover is an agricultural research advisor in USAID's Bureau for Food Security, with a focus on sub-Saharan Africa. Prior to working with USAID, Jerry studied grassland and agricultural ecosystems for more than a decade at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. His work on developing perennial grain crops has been highlighted in articles in National Geographic and Nature, which recognize Jerry as one of the 5 crop researchers who could change the world. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thanks. Nice to be speaking with you.
So we're talking about crops that never need to be replaced. So the article says that before agriculture, most of the planet was covered with plants that lived year after year, and the perennials were gradually replaced by food crops that do have to be replanted. Is that true? Did agriculture cause that?
Nearly all of our land-based natural plant communities, whether we're talking about tropical rainforests or large grasslands of North America and so on, those were dominated by perennial plants that, as you said, typically don't need to be replanted. They regrow by their root systems each year. Those were converted over the past several thousand to 10,000 years of agricultural history to primarily crops that are annuals. They do have to be replanted each year by seeds. Now, one thing that you did say, though, is that we're working toward developing perennial grain crops that never need to be replanted. I suppose that might be the high ideal, the really high bar of achievement. But I think it's much more realistic to imagine shorter-lived perennials. When we talk about a perennial, it could be a plant that lives anywhere from 3 to 1,000 years. So this idea of a perennial plant covers a wide range of longevity. And that's an important consideration because, farmers want some flexibility. They may not want to produce the same type of wheat each year for the next 1,000 years.
Right.
So the ability for farmers to grow crops and plant them only when they need to, or maybe after a few years when they absolutely have to, rather than replanting them each year. That replanting requires a lot of work to prepare the field in which to plant the seeds. Imagine wheat, rice, and corn. I think most people are very familiar with those three crops, and with good reason. Those are annual grain crops. And those three crops alone contribute some 60 to 70% of human calories around the planet. They're high-energy food sources for humans. And there's quite a range of other crops that fall into that category of grains, such as sunflowers that we use as an oilseed crop, soybeans. Many people, of course, are familiar with soybeans. And sorghum, millet. So there's quite a range of grain crops, currently all of which are annuals that we rely on for food. And that is what this sort of loose network of scientists around the world wish to change, is to develop perennial versions of those major grain crops that actually function much more like the native plant communities that agriculture has replaced.
Tell us about the advantages of perennials.
There's quite a range of benefits that perennials have over their annual counterparts. Number one, and this may be one of the more important aspects, is that perennial plants tend to have root systems that are 3 to 6 feet or 10 feet, even 12 feet longer than their annual counterparts. So, for example, let's take wheat. Annual crop wheat that provides a tremendous proportion of human calories around the planet. Its root system is primarily restricted to the surface 6 inches to 12 inches of soil. One of our major crops, wheat, is relying primarily on 6 to 12 inches of soil to obtain its nutrients, to obtain water, and so on for growth. Its wild perennial relative, wheatgrass, that is a close relative, by the way, it's a perennial, its root system extends 12 to 14 feet down into the soil, and so it's able to take advantage of nutrients and water that our annual crop wheat cannot even access. The other critical factor, and this is maybe equally important, is the length of growing season that perennials have. Because they can regrow after harvest, if we had a perennial grain crop, you could go in and harvest the seed off of it for food, but then it regrows, capturing sunlight, and again, protecting the soil surface and putting plant sugars below ground that the roots then feed into the soil. And that's an important concept because plants are the primary regulators of what's going on below the soil surface, feeding all those little microorganisms that make a soil healthy. And function well in terms of producing a plant. So those two things, the longer growing season and access to sunlight and ability to tap into important resources such as nutrients and water deeper within the soil convey quite a few benefits just in terms of how the landscape functions, how water flows through the system, how nutrients are managed, and so on. Now, getting to the human aspect of things, we have a few other benefits, not the least of which is reducing the need to prepare large fields, or even small fields for that matter, for seed planting each year. With an annual crop such as wheat or rice or corn, farmers have to go out and prepare the field. They have to make it suitable to plant a seed into and for that seed to germinate and grow up to be harvested. With a perennial version of the grain crops, when there's sunlight available, water is available, nutrients are available, and the temperature is suitable for plant growth, the perennial would emerge on its own from its own root system, would grow up and produce seeds that could be harvested, grains, and then following that harvest, it'll regrow. And that provides opportunities for farmers to harvest the vegetative regrowth for other uses, such as for livestock. Some people have suggested it could be harvested for biomass, for biofuels programs, and so on.
Right.
So there's a whole suite of opportunities there. And I personally, in working in the United States and around the world, believe that those ecological and farmer benefits conveyed by perennials are most immediately useful and most useful in many of the regions of the world that currently suffer from great widespread landscape degradation and food insecurity. Just thinking of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, many of those landscapes have degraded significantly following conversion from the native plant communities to agriculture, which primarily features annual crops. Getting perennial versions of the grain crops available in these regions could significantly reverse the land degradation and reduce the vulnerability of farmers to things like climate change.
Well, something I found really interesting was the fact that conventionally grown crops are a source of atmospheric carbon, but perennials, because they don't require tilling and such, they turn into a carbon sink.
That's a bit of a complex story, but up front it's fairly simple. If you don't disturb the soil and don't burn diesel or gasoline in order to prepare the soil, and you don't have to necessarily put on as much fertilizer, and you maintain a healthy soil and so on, yes, you will, at the very least, decrease the amount of greenhouse gases emitted. And at least in the initial years of converting from annual cropping systems to perennial cropping systems, 10 to 20 years, it's likely that you will build up soil carbon and maybe more importantly, reduce those other greenhouse gases such as nitrous oxides and other emissions that would come from equipment operation, driving a tractor across the field. So yes, if we wish to at least reduce or even turn agriculture into a net sink for greenhouse gases, perennials would offer many opportunities to do that. Having said that, it's very difficult to get carbon, which is often stored in soils as organic matter. I think a lot of people are familiar with organic matter because that's what gardeners are always encouraged to increase in their gardens. And that's where a lot of carbon is stored in the soil. It's much more difficult to get that organic matter built up on large areas than it is to burn it off. And by burn it off, I mean, microorganisms attacking it and CO2 being emitted by our annual crop practices. So even with perennials, it's an uphill battle to use croplands as ultimate sinks of greenhouse gases that we emit through our, industrial lifestyles.
Are these plants already in use? Are they being sold?
I believe your question really is, where are we with perennial grain crop development? Is that what you're asking?
Indeed.
Then the answer is it depends on which crops we're talking about.
Right.
So the one that shows the most promise in the most immediate future for the most marginal landscapes and the most vulnerable people, I believe, is this long-lived pigeon pea. Pigeon peas are a protein-rich legume, sort of like a bean or a pea. that's grown in Africa. And in Malawi, for example, farmers, with the assistance of some scientific research on farm, have adopted the use of these perennial pigeon peas into their maize and soybean or maize and peanut systems. So the farmers are growing pigeon peas, these perennial pigeon peas, with their maize or corn. And then when they harvest the corn, you know, the pigeon peas are still growing, then they can harvest this nice protein-rich pigeon pea. Then they plant soybeans, and they get a soybean harvest and another pigeon pea harvest. And the contribution of the pigeon pea to that system is the nitrogen that they can provide. Legumes, in many cases, are able to use nitrogen out of the atmosphere for their own use, and they often can supply some to the other crops. Pigeon pea is very good at that. So they provide some nitrogen to the corn crop, and they provide some nice conditions for growing soybeans as well. So farmers there, often when we're talking about farmers in that region, we're talking about women, are able to harvest a lot more protein to feed to their families. And they get similar or higher maize yields. If you compare it to maize yields where no fertilizer has been applied, it's radically higher yields. So a lot of benefits from just integrating that one perennial crop into a maize and soybean system. So that's immediately available. It's being used by farmers in places. I believe that the potential for expanding its use is great. Now, as we move on to other crops, let's take probably one of the more difficult crops to develop a perennial version of, maize, or people call it corn. That will probably take at least 20 years to develop. The bright spot in the development of a perennial version of corn is the use of high-tech genotyping approaches in which scientists are able to look at the genetic makeup of these of the plants that they're working with and determine whether they're suitable for crossing with other corn parents or will be discarded. In the past, it would take maybe years for scientists to, you know, characterize a perennial plant to determine if it has suitable characteristics. You have to plant the seed that you're working with, let it grow up, and evaluate it over a period of years. Well, by being able to instantly analyze the genetic makeup of these plants, scientists are able to reduce from, for example, 6 years to 2 years, the amount of time required to get suitable results. So that's quite a reduction, you know, a threefold reduction in the amount of time to achieve the same results. So that makes corn, a perennial corn, feasible within 20 years.
Are there any downfalls to this? Because I am having a really hard time thinking critically about these crops because it sounds amazing, but I'm trying not to be too overly optimistic.
You know, if we look at some of the downsides, some of the concerns, one is that if a perennial grain crop gets established, how easy is it for a farmer to switch to another crop? Let's say the market for that particular grain goes down and the farmer wants to plant tomatoes instead of wheat. Does a perennial grain crop reduce the flexibility of that system? And I can imagine situations in which it might. If, for example, it requires a lot of labor to get rid of that perennial grain crop. So that's one of the concerns of scientists, is that they're not creating weeds. And so a large amount of attention in developing perennial grain crops goes into that, and to ensure that they add to the flexibility of a farmer rather than take away the flexibility. Another potential source of concern is competition for resources. Although perennials can tap into deeper nutrient water sources, they also are, you know, tapping into the surface resources as well. So in many situations, they're not competing, but we can imagine situations in which they might. So, you know, the solution to all this is that once they're developed and you thoroughly test them in local conditions, determine where they're well-suited and where they're not well-suited, determine if further work can make them better suited. So you do have to, these scientists very much have to consider the specific local conditions. But let's remember, you know, prior to agriculture, nearly all of our landscapes were covered in, were at least dominated by perennial plants. So the potential for perennials on a tremendous range of landscapes is high, I believe. So we do have to be concerned about some of the potential downsides, and that's where the research comes into play following the plant breeding. Of course, at some point, the plant breeding starts to go hand in hand with the on-the-ground, on-the-farm research to determine their suitability.
More science is always the answer, sir.
Yeah, and of course, speaking as a scientist, that's one of the traps we fall into, right? But I think, at least in the agricultural research community, this is my hope more than a hope, we have gotten better at looking at what the local farmers have done in the past, what they're doing now, and looking to ways to improve those practices rather than just outright change them. The use of perennial pigeon pea in the maize soybean systems is a terrific example. These pigeon peas were often, in the past, grown with maize or especially sorghum probably. But then at some point, agricultural scientists went in and said, you know, you really should just grow a single crop at a single time so that there's not competition. Forget about this more complex intercropping and so on. And that had benefits for a while. But after a while, people began to see the downsides. You're perhaps more vulnerable to weather events. You know, a drought wipes out your maize and you've got nothing else, or a big rainfall wipes out your corn crop and you've got nothing left. So I think as an agricultural science community, we now view advances in agriculture, such as the development of perennial grain crops, in the context of the local conditions and the local need, with a much higher priority on the local environmental and social context than was taken into consideration in the past. Of course, you know, we have to be careful not to think that we've got everything taken care of and nailed down, and that, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's mistakes that will still be made, but I do think we take that much more into consideration today.
That was Jerry Glover, Agricultural Research Advisor in USAID's Bureau for Food Security with a focus on sub-Saharan Africa. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with more of Scientific American's World-Changing Ideas after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're teaming up with Scientific American to bring you part two of our series on the technologies profiled in their World-Changing Ideas feature article. We'll talk to Scientific American editors and writers and researchers who are developing cutting-edge tech that just might shape the future of our society and our planet. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Michael Moyer is the senior editor in charge of technology coverage for Scientific American. Now, we've spoken about superbugs on the show before, but if you could just give us a quick refresher, what are they?
Over the 20th century, we became very good at fighting bacterial infections through the use of antibiotics, and it's saved millions and millions of lives. We've become so good at preventing bacterial infections that we've started to use antibiotics for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes your doctor may give you a prescription for antibiotics even if you just have a cold, which is a virus. Agriculture, a lot of farmers will give their animals antibiotics to prevent them from getting sick in the first place. Now, of course, antibiotics work, but only so well. They don't kill all of the bacteria. And so what happens is the bacteria which are resistant to the antibiotics, they're the only ones that are left. And what happens is that you have strains of bacteria that evolve to be resistant to antibiotics. What we've seen, especially in the last decade or so, is the rise of some pretty scary, what we call superbugs. MRSA, or methylococcus-resistant staph infection, is one of the worst of them. And these are infections which will literally eat the flesh off of your skin, and which doctors have no tools to fight. So we have this great problem with superbugs, found especially in institutional settings such as hospitals or prisons or gymnasiums. Sometimes they're found. And we're kind of running out of tools to fight them off with.
So it goes without saying, then, that researching an effective treatment has been high on the list of things to do.
Indeed. It's really almost as if we've been caught with our pants down on this one.
And it's our fault.
You know, and it's there is a responsible way to use antibiotics. And certainly no one is suggesting that if you have an ear, nose, and throat infection, which is bacterial in nature, or if your child has an ear infection, that you shouldn't use antibiotics. Of course, that's why they're there. But it's through the overuse of antibiotics that we've really accelerated the development of these very highly resistant superbugs. And so researchers have been looking all over the place to try and find completely out of left field ideas to try and figure out a way to fight them.
Which brings us to the nanotech knife. So what is that?
So the nanotech knife is this really cool, scary idea. It's a nanoparticle which is designed to bind to one of these superbugs and basically go in and invert itself and poke a hole in the cell membrane. And once you poke a hole in the cell membrane, it's kind of like a water balloon. Everything in the inside just kind of squirts out. So you have these nanoparticles which come in and basically just gut all of these bacterial cells.
Now, what does this have to do with a positive charge and a negative charge?
These bacterial membranes have a negative charge. And so the way that scientists have designed these nanoparticles is that they've given the nanoparticles shells with a positive charge. And so what happens is the particle comes in, attaches, and turns itself inside out to drill right into the membrane.
So is it possible for them to, let's say, accidentally puncture things that are not bacterial membranes?
The convenient fact about things like human cells, like red blood cells, for example, is that they don't have the same electrical charge that the bacterial membranes do. And so it's exploiting that difference between the human cell and the bacterial cell charge, which ensures that these nano knives are not going to come in and start attacking the rest of your cells, which would, of course, be very inconvenient because our cells have the same property of not being able to survive if you poke a hole in their cell membranes.
Yeah, okay, this is disturbing. So after they've done what they were supposed to do, then what? Do they die? Or actually, can nanoparticles die, really?
Well, they're not living organisms. So they don't die, but they can be broken down. And so what happens is that after they've done their job, body's enzymes come in and break them down, and then they get flushed out of the body like any other foreign object.
And we haven't tested these in humans yet, correct?
They're right now, still in the idea early testing phase. They've been shown in some proof of concept experiments. The hope is to start human trials in the next few years.
How would this be used in a clinical setting?
Fortunately, it's not. It wouldn't be an orally ingested drug. MRSA, as I described it, is a flesh-eating bacteria, colloquially termed. And so doctors in a healthcare setting would squirt a gel that contained these nanoparticles and apply this gel to the wound. And so you would have this direct application of the nanoparticles to the bacterial cells in question.
So basically kind of similar to the antibiotics we use now, the ones that we overused and laid the ground for resistant strains.
I sense in your question won't any offensive measure against bacteria lead to the same problems that we have right now?
You win a prize.
Yeah. And I guess my answer is, of course, because bacteria are living organisms, and they evolve, on fast timescales. It's like trying to come up with the flu vaccine, for instance.
Right.
Why do you have to get a flu vaccine every year? It's because the viruses that cause the flu evolve from year to year. And so, the health organizations have to figure out, okay, what's going to be the virus for next year, and let's create the antibodies for that virus. It's the same thing. And so if you describe it as a cat and mouse game, it's not inaccurate. But what's our other option, really, is to just say, well, okay, the microbes win?
Well, how could we avoid the same situation that we're in now? What have we learned here?
One thing that I think we've learned that clearly we haven't learned because it's still going on is that we need to stop the overuse of antibiotics. And that would happen in a number of ways. One is better doctor and also patient education. A lot of patients will go into a doctor and demand antibiotics, even if it's something that the doctor knows is not treatable with antibiotics because it's a viral infection. But in order to make their patient happy, they will give them the antibiotic prescription, thinking that, well, it's, you know, not really going to cause too much of a problem. Of course, it's a collective action problem, in that if everyone does that, then you get these terrible drug-resistant infections. Another big issue is the agricultural issue, in that, you know, the way that pigs and cows and chickens are grown, ranchers and farmers often give their animals antibiotics, not only so that they don't get sick in a lot of the confined spaces in which they're grown in, but also some strains of antibiotics will help the animals grow more quickly. Clearly, that's a public policy issue that has to be addressed, has not been addressed effectively, at least I know in the U.S. I don't know in Canada. There have been countries in Europe which have effectively banned that sort of use of antibiotics, the use of antibiotics for anything other than giving it to sick animals. They have not shown any decreases in the amount of cows. I'm thinking specifically of the Netherlands and their cows, the amount of cattle that they're able to produce. It hasn't been the disaster that a lot of farmers' groups said. So I think that that's something that needs to be done with much haste.
To extend that to the nano knife, so not using them for everything from the common cold to cancer, perhaps?
Yes. So, you know, an experimental product like this, certainly that's going to be tested in the next few years, would not be used in anything except for the most difficult and egregious cases. You could imagine a future in 20 years from now when just every hospital has this sort of nano knife stocked, and somebody comes in and has a bad infection and they're like, oh, you know, we'll just inject you with some of that. Antibiotics are still going to have their place in the world, but we need to start developing the big guns for the really problematic bacteria.
That was Michael Moyer, the senior editor in charge of technology coverage for Scientific American. Christopher Mims is a journalist who specializes in sustainability and technology. He blogs for Technology Review, Grist, Smart Planet, and Fast Company, and writes articles for Wired, Scientific American, Technologist, and Slate. And lately, he's been helping friends launch an experiment in alternate funding models for science and environment-focused media called Major Planet. Now, we've been talking about electric cars for years, but they just really haven't made it into the mainstream. Why is that?
I mean, electric cars actually date back to the invention of the internal combustion engine. So it would be easy to look at it as a conspiracy between the infant oil companies and, right, and Henry Ford. But the truth is, it's not. Gasoline has always been able to store much more energy per unit of volume than batteries have. I mean, it was true 100 years ago. It's true today. So electric cars simply don't have the what's called energy density in their batteries to give them the same power and range as you know, a conventional gasoline fueled vehicle. Of course, the reason we're talking about electric cars now is that it turns out that, you know, our reliance on oil, which is the number one source of energy for the entire world, has consequences for the climate, and oil is getting harder to find. It's more expensive than ever.
So now there's a couple of different kinds of batteries. There's flow batteries and then there's lithium ion batteries. Can you explain sort of the difference between how they work?
The really big kinds of batteries that people are talking about using for the electrical grid to, say, store wind energy so that it can be used when the wind isn't blowing, or solar energy so it can be used at night when the sun isn't shining. Those kinds of batteries are usually flow batteries, and they don't store a lot of energy per pound of electrolyte, but their contents are entirely liquid. So if you want to add capacity, you just add another tank, and it just gets pumped through these huge pipes, and that can be used for very large applications. But lithium-ion batteries are kind of the current state-of-the-art in the consumer electronics world for energy density, which means they can store more energy per unit of, you know, volume or weight than any other battery. And that's why for example, your phone can go all day or go for days, even though it's a pretty energy-hungry device.
So this new battery then would combine elements of both of those?
It does it in a way that's challenging to explain, but it's kind of worth understanding. So in a normal battery, you have liquid contents, and you also have like an anode and a cathode, which means the sort of what you're used to thinking of as the positive and the negative end of the battery. And these are usually just solid pieces of metal, or they might have some unique three-dimensional shape to give them more surface area. And it's the exchange of ions or electrons between the different components of the battery that allows it to either discharge or recharge. And what's different about this battery is that those parts of the battery that are normally solid have been broken into little tiny nanoscale particles. And that means that the effective surface area of the parts of this battery that would normally be solid is very, very high. But it also represents kind of a new approach to building batteries in general. You know, lithium ion batteries, as we know them, that's just one kind of what's called a battery chemistry. And there are other battery chemistries. There's different combinations of metals and organic components that can go into a battery. But when you break the normally solid parts of the battery into these very, very small components, and you put them into this slurry, suddenly you create something that can have twice the energy storage of a conventional lithium-ion battery. But also, because it's very nearly liquid, it can flow. And so that leads to some interesting potential applications, one of which is, imagine that you had this kind of battery in your car, and you pulled up to a gas station, and instead of filling up on gasoline, you would fill up on this charged electrolyte, stick the nozzle into your car in the same way as you do now, and the old discharged electrolyte inside your car would be pumped out, and the new charged electrolyte would be pumped in. Well, what's interesting about that is currently, you know, if you have an electric car like a Nissan Leaf, depending on what kind of charging situation you have, it could take you all night to recharge that car's battery. But when you put something into a liquid form and you can physically move it from one place to another, you can recharge a car very quickly. And so I think that's what captured people's imagination with this discovery. But independent of the fact that this is a sort of a liquid battery, it's also just interesting because potentially it could have twice the energy density of current batteries. And that's relevant because current batteries are pretty good. We've been working on this technology for decades. You know, if a Nissan Leaf can go about 100 miles with its current battery configuration, if we could double that, it gets to the point that the range of that vehicle is kind of irrelevant for most applications. You know, very few people, unless they're on a road trip, are going to travel more than a couple hundred miles in a day. So that means that then electric cars could be used by, you know, the majority of Americans.
Right. It's not just cars that you could use these batteries in. What else are they looking at?
Well, what's interesting about this battery, and I think sort of this industry in general, is, you know, everybody has to figure out, where can I sell this battery until I have enough scale to make this battery affordable enough for everyone? So, you know, we think of electric cars and we imagine these giant batteries inside them. Well, I mean, if you broke up a Tesla Roadster, which is the fanciest electric car available, it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars, inside you would find hundreds of tiny AA battery size lithium ion batteries. So why do you have so many? It's a waste of packaging. Well, the answer is all current lithium ion batteries were developed for consumer electronics. The demand was laptops, cell phones.
Right.
So that industry is what launched lithium ion batteries and made them cheap enough for us to start using them in cars. It wasn't like the battery companies could sit around for 20 years while they developed the chemistry waiting for the Chevrolet Volt to come along. So in the same way, the folks at MIT behind this battery, who've had success previously with lithium ion batteries, are trying out a different application, which is that they want to build really massive grid-scale batteries. These are batteries large enough to contain enough energy to power a small town overnight, let's say. So you have a big wind farm somewhere, and it's producing extra electricity, you know, at some points during the day. That's stored in these giant grid-scale batteries, which, I mean, literally physically giant, like the size of, you know, a building or something. And then it's discharged when it's necessary. And it turns out that if you have just a little bit of this capacity in the grid, it can go a long way toward making it easier to put renewables onto the grid, because, you know, the grid has to be balanced at all times. The amount of energy going in has to equal the amount of energy going out. And sometimes the wind stops blowing. Sometimes clouds pass over entire solar arrays in the desert, and then you see this huge drop in energy production. So you have to be ready for that. And, you know, you also have to account for the fact that there are times when renewable energy simply isn't available. So just putting a small percentage of the grid's total capacity into the grid in the form of batteries turns out to have this really big effect on the total amount of renewable energy you can put on the grid. So that's the application they're going for. And if they're right, they'll sell an enormous amount of this technology because so much is needed.
But there are some problems currently.
Well, I mean, one thing that's important to understand about these batteries is that this is a preliminary discovery. So it's not preliminary in the sense that, you know, we just discovered a new physical effect and maybe 20 years from now we can exploit it. I mean, they do have a working prototype, but it's not available commercially yet. You know, they're setting up a venture to commercialize it, which, I mean, shows they have a great deal of confidence in it. But there could be problems. So one of the problems is because this is a liquid battery, its contents have to be pumped throughout the battery. And when they were creating it, they were worried that these nanoscale particles inside this battery slurry would actually just grind down every surface inside the battery. It would be like sandblasting it or something. Mm-hmm. That appears not to be the case, but it's also not clear whether the pumps and other parts that this battery requires won't weigh so much that they'll cancel out its advantageous energy density versus conventional batteries. The jury's still out on whether this will ultimately represent a real step change in what we can do with, you know, batteries and electric vehicles, let's say.
Well, there was also concern that the batteries would actually be slower than conventional batteries.
That's right. So one problem that these batteries have is that they could potentially charge slower than conventional lithium-ion batteries. And so that depends a lot on the application. Now, if you're talking about electric vehicles and you're charging them at home, that's a problem. If you're talking about a giant grid-scale battery that's being charged from a wind farm or something, it's not as much of an issue. So that could be one reason that they're targeting these grid-scale applications first.
So overall, this is promising, but maybe they're not quite there yet?
Yeah, we have to wait for commercialization. But I will say that the team behind this is also the team behind the company A123 Systems. If you buy any Black & Decker product, power drill, whatever, they're the ones who enabled all of our tools at home to store enough energy to be rechargeable.
Well, speaking about world-changing ideas, since I have you on the line, can you tell us a bit about Major Planet?
Sure. Major Planet is something I'm helping a friend out with. His name is Michael Corin. He has been at a number of different news desks that have been dissolved because there's less and less environmental coverage
right.
than ever. So he was looking around at alternate ways to fund journalism that's about science and about the environment. And we're working on a bunch of different projects right now, one of which is helping publishers get their content onto tablets in a way that makes it really accessible, because we think that's where all this stuff is going.
Please hurry, sir. We need help. Christopher, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
This episode of Skeptically Speaking was produced in cooperation with Scientific American magazine. You'll find links to their 10 world-changing ideas feature on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and on iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next week for part 2 of 10 World-Changing Ideas from Scientific American and Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.